Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Don't Tell Me the Score, the podcast that uses sport to explore life's bigger questions. My name is Simon Mundy, and each week I sit down with an expert, from the biggest sporting names in the world to Buddhist monks, neuroscientists, psychologists, and philosophers. We discuss a theme that tells us something insightful and important about life and how best to live it, from the importance of self-acceptance to facing addiction and developing resilience, right through to getting your circadian rhythms in sync and how to sleep better. Sport is a metaphor for life, and in this podcast, I aim to prove that right. I always like hearing from you, so the best way to get in touch is via my website, simonmundy.com, or I'm at Simon Mundy on social media. In this episode, I'm talking to Kate Richardson-Walsh, who was captain when Great Britain won gold in hockey at the Rio 2016 Olympics. And the theme of the episode is being a role model. Kate, how
Hello.
Are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm really well, thank you. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So, you and Helen, pregnant.
Yes.
How exciting.
Really exciting. New chapter. Something to look forward to. We're taking, you know, as new up-and-coming parents do, expectant parents, they take, you know, bits of information and tips from everybody. So we're getting lots of that, which is nice.
A December baby, you were telling me?
Yes.
Hopefully.
Hopefully, yeah. Fingers crossed, all being well. Yeah, I love Christmas. Christmas for me starts December the 1st. So, yeah. You know, that whole month's going to be very exciting.
Well, I was saying, I'm a December baby. And yeah, there are definite Sagittarian traits, both good and bad.
Such as? What?
Well, so I read somewhere that, or someone told me once, prone to social blunders. And I thought, okay, like quite outgoing, but can occasionally put their foot in it with perhaps like a bit of bluntness. I thought, yeah, that sounds about right.
Oh, but black, I quite like bluntness. Well,
exactly.
Black's for positive for me. Yeah, yeah. Blunt is good.
And what are you?
I'm a Taurian, so I'm very blunt.
And you buy into that as well.
I've got a tattoo on my wrist to be remind myself to be kind to my Taurian ways, yeah.
I hope it goes very well. Very exciting news. And let's talk about you. The captain's captain. I like the way your eyes have got this kind of fear in it. A role model, a winner, a leader, a champion, and a jolly nice woman. 375 caps. How many goals did you get?
49 goals, one short of the 50.
Is that a bit of a sore point?
Yeah.
But I tell you, what a career, though. 375 appearances. Other sports don't get anywhere near that.
We certainly did play a lot of games, and particularly in, you know, the lead-up to sort of the London Olympics, when lots of teams were coming over. They wanted to come and play over here on the pitch, at the venue, or see what we were up to. So we played lots of matches.
Now, we're going to talk about your story and also dissect the lessons you've learned along the way. And I know you've got lots of gems. But let's start back at the beginning, where you grew up in a very sporty family. That's a bit handy, isn't it? Both parents as PE teachers.
Yeah, both mum and dad, really sporty. Dad kind of played cricket, football when we were really young and before we were born. And then love him kind of put that to the wayside. Still played cricket over the summer, but then was really just ferrying us around everywhere. Mum played hockey, netball, indoor cricket. I mean, literally anything they could have a go at, they would play. Opposite our house was a little cul-de-sac, and there was a group of kids, and we grew up, and there's a block of flats at the end of that cul-de-sac, and we'd do mini Olympics around that. Mm-hmm. So what I remember from my childhood is outside, running around the roads, doing all sorts. And I am quite rubbish at a lot of other sports.
Oh, really?
I'm really not.
That surprises me.
It surprises a lot of people. Not me, because I've grown up that way. I'll have a go, but I'm just... I grew up swimming. and doing gymnastics. They were my two main sports when I was growing up. And I'd, you know, we'd have tennis rackets in the back garden and swing ball and all that kind of stuff you have. My dad's cricket bat out, but I just never took to any of those.
Really?
And so didn't really play them at all.
But you've clearly got good hand-eye coordination, so that surprises me.
Questionable.
Really? I guess you've got to hit the ball in hockey. That's the whole point.
Yeah. I wasn't a technical player, I think let's say that. I was very fortunate at the time I came through the system. There was a kind of change in mentality, the kind of player they were looking for in hockey, and it was a kind of an athletic player, and I was quite strong and pretty fit and could repeat effort. So that was just perfect for me.
That's interesting. Yeah. So how did you actually get into hockey?
Just at my local school. So I went to my local comprehensive secondary school. Mm-hmm. I'm a PE teacher. Beverly Kinder was our teacher, and hockey was one of the sports we did. So we did hockey, netball in the winter, and then we did rounders and athletics in the summer. And as soon as I picked it up, I loved it. There was something about, I think, the team element. So I'd been, as I said, doing gymnastics and swimming, and they were quite kind of, here's a mat, do, you know, as many backward walkovers as you can, or, you know, here's this swimming session, put on the float at the end of the lane, do it. And I loved the competitions for gymnastics, and I loved the relays and swimming. And so it made sense then that I loved the team element of hockey.
Yeah. And you said as well that hockey gave you the space and confidence to belong.
Yeah, I was really shy.
Were you?
I was so shy. Like painfully so. And I blushed when I would speak, you know, like even this, just a one-on-one conversation, I would blush. And then once I'd sense myself blushing, I would get embarrassed because I'd think they're staring at me now thinking, why is she blushing? Mm-hmm. And my brain was working overtime. Exactly. And so then I would just stop putting myself in those situations. And I never kind of, I was bullied at primary school. I mean, lots of kids are. Mm-hmm. And I just never seemed to fit in with any group of people. And then I started playing hockey and I just felt like I belonged. It was just the best feeling ever. And I literally found my voice. And, you know, because people couldn't really understand, like, how are you so quiet off the pitch? And then you go on there and you're commanding people, moving people around. And I didn't know.
Sport does that for so many people. That seems to be a really common thread.
Yeah. We just want, I think, a belonging is a real human need, isn't it? It's a deep-rooted human need. And if you find it, you will cling on to it.
Absolutely. And so from starting in hockey, within, 9 years, you're playing at the Olympics? That's a pretty steep, fast curve.
Yeah, with a big, massive lesson pretty early doors as well.
Which was?
So I was selected for the England Under-16s when I was 14, mm-hmm. Kind of the year before perhaps you maybe should. And I just kind of followed my nose. I hadn't aimed for it. I hadn't, you know, done anything specific to get there. And so I wasn't training. I was eating like a packet of cookies, watching Neighbours at school every day. I was going to the park with my mates, doing things I shouldn't be doing. I just was just that age. And then the next year, when maybe I should have been selected, I was dropped. And I remember the letter, I still get emotional now, the letter coming through the post, because that's what you found out in those days. And there was a list of names printed and my name wasn't on there. And my parents kind of sat me down, and I remember my mum specifically saying to me, you know, what do you want to do about it? Which I remember at the time thinking, that is so harsh. But it was the best question, because it was a kind of in my gift. What did I want? Where did I want to take this? And, you know, age 15, that's a pretty massive life question to be asking yourself. And I hadn't had any, I was rudderless. I didn't really know where I was going. I wasn't steering myself in any direction at all. And you couldn't have been a professional hockey player, certainly. And even to be a professional sportswoman, that it seemed very distant and nothing really for me. But so what I did do was say, OK, I wanted to be the best hockey player I can. It was a period of about a year that I just made so many choices, which would then help me on that journey. So I went to a different college, went to a different hockey club that was my nearest National League club. It was an hour and 45 minutes away. My dad, bless him, would take me there twice a week. Started eating properly. I then learned to love to run. I hated running. I cannot tell you how much I hated running. I started to learn to love the discipline of it, the discipline of training. And again, found a place where I belonged with this group of women at Hightown Hockey Club up in Formby, with international players. The international coach was there, and I was like, right, this is for me. I love it.
Mm. So there was that fork in the road.
Yeah.
And learning from adversity, very key. And a lot of people do that. And they say that, you know, those tough moments sort of make you, can make you or break you. Obviously, clearly in your case, it did make you, and your mum as well, having that very intelligent conversation and giving you full responsibility as well. So you knew then it was all down to you.
Absolutely. And that again, is, I guess, through my career, the empowerment. If somebody empowers you to take responsibility, it is in your hands to run with it, drive it. If it doesn't work, it's what are you going to do about it?
Could you have quit at that point? What if your mum hadn't have had that conversation with you?
Yeah.
Could it have knocked you over?
I would have been another stat. I probably would have been another stat. And I meet, when I go around and do talks and stuff, and I meet so many women that said, oh, I played, you know, for my county, or I played for my territory, and I played England under 16s. But then I never got picked again, and I don't play hockey anymore. That absolutely could have been me.
Mm. So after that point, you completely, like you said, developed a love of discipline and running and eating properly and doing everything you need to do to be a top professional, got back in the team.
Mm-hmm.
Let's fast forward then to the age of 23,
which
was a pretty staggering moment. And okay, for someone who says, you know, that you were shy...
Mm.
So the team, you thought that they were looking to get a selection of captains. So they all asked you and your peers who should be leaders.
Yeah, so we'd had, we hadn't really had a captain for a period of time. We went through massive loads of changes. From my first cap in 99 to 2003, we'd had three separate lots of coaches. Oh, goodness knows how many captaincies in that. So there was so much change. It just felt like a really tempestuous time. And nobody really wanted to be an out-and-out captain. And actually, co-captains was working out pretty well for us. So we were voting in Sydney. I remember in Parramatta in a hotel, we were voting for co-captains. So we'd all kind of written our votes down. The coaches went out of the room to top them all up. And then Tricia Heberly, the head coach, came back in and said, OK, well, we were voting for co-captains, but there's been an overriding... an overwhelming vote for one person, so we're going to actually just have one captain. I was just like totally stunned.
When she said there's going to be one captain, did you pop up, or who were you thinking of?
No, I was thinking one of my teammates who'd been one of the co-captains,
right.
And was a senior player, because I was 23, so there's players in the team 10 years older than me, you know, way more experienced than me. And I was really proud, obviously, so proud, but shocked. And I, you know, it wasn't completely out of the, you know, realms of reality. I'd been captain of the under 21 team. I'd captained, you know, other teams. So it wasn't completely out of the window. But it was really proud.
That's a great process, even for them to have gone through in the first place. Because it's quite a rare way of choosing a captain, isn't it? And it empowers you and your teammates.
Yeah, and I think latterly with under Danny Kerry, when we voted for our captaincy on our leadership group, we did it around our, off the back of our culture. So once we created our vision, values and behaviours, we then voted for that group because they were going to lead us specifically on that. So that, I think, was even more powerful. But absolutely, you're given a mandate straight away. These people want you to lead them.
Yeah.
And that's really, it felt great. Yeah.
What do you think it was that set you apart? And have you heard from people in the team? Have they told you what it was that made you stand out?
No. And, you know, I get asked this question a lot, and I think, you know, I should probably just ask a few of them.
Yeah. What do you think? No British modesty.
I think the way I played and the way I was at that time, I was really conscious of being the best role model I could, setting the best example that I could. So, you know, pushing myself in training, demanding standards and challenging things. I was very conscious of doing what I could, and that if I did that, then I could challenge other people to do the same thing. So that was the basis of it all.
Yeah.
You know, and I look back now and I think, I was doing awfully at some things. Like some of my relationships with players, some of my relationships with the staff was just not of the level or the standard, but I was 23.
Sure.
I was doing the best I could at the time.
Which is obviously very good, you know, to get the nod from so many of your peers, like stand out.
Yeah, I mean, I genuinely would like to ask them.
Why don't you?
I know, I should. I will. I will.
And it all seems to, you know, chart back again to that letter that you got, you know, where you decided, okay, to take responsibility for yourself and do all these things. And once they're embedded in you, then it's like, okay, I can be an example to other people.
No, I mean, I have to say I was supported by, at that time when I was 15, by just some amazing people in my family. Some coaches had some really hard conversations with me, you know, and there was lots of people at that time helped me with that decision, certainly.
You said you took the responsibility of playing as well as captaincy very, very seriously. So it's all consuming for you.
Yeah, I was all in. So when I think about it, I think I was all in every sense.
So was everything aligned towards, you know, the team and being a good captain in your life, pretty much?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, which I just found totally normal. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until, you know, quite far down the road and someone said, you're obsessed. And it wasn't said in a nice way. And I was like, yeah, I am. And I feel really positive about that. But I also feel like now, having stepped away and got a different perspective, that because me as a person and me as a captain and me as a hockey player was so entwined, we were so one, that then when I left, that's why that transition of leaving the sport, I think, was that much harder, because I felt like I'd lost myself.
Of course. That's very common.
Absolutely. But it's you know, is there a way of being all in? Because I think you have to be all in. Mm-hmm. You're doing something extraordinary. You're asking yourself and your teammates to do something completely out of the ordinary. Is there a way of maintaining that, actually just who you are, and that's a separate thing? I don't know.
Or is it just accepting that the grief comes at the end of it?
Yeah.
You know, that's quite normal. Like, you are grieving a part of yourself, aren't you?
Yeah.
It's kind of a normal process. Perhaps we just don't think of it that way.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's fair.
I was watching a few videos in which you were speaking, and you spoke about, you know, your approach and how it contrasted with some of your teammates. And you didn't name whoever it was, but you said that there was another teammate who didn't have that all-consuming approach that you did, and you couldn't understand it at the time, yet found out later that actually, hang on, this is what worked for them. And I found that really interesting. You know, it's kind of horses for courses, isn't it? We are all different. It's what works for everyone. So yeah, just tell us about that.
Yeah, I think in any group of people there's going to be people that you clash with, and likely some of the reasons that you clash with those people is because your values or your perspectives, so you're coming at it from a different point of view. Your end point is the same and the goal is the same, but I think when you can't understand where the other person is coming from and they can't understand where you're coming from at the same time, then that's when the clashes happen. And yeah, I just wish, I hate regrets. So it's not that I regret it. I just kind of wish I'd spent a bit more time with this person at the time, really trying to understand where they were coming from and why they wanted to go about it in that way. I might have still disagreed.
Yeah.
But I feel like I at least would have understood.
So what was the other way? What, they would switch off away from the hockey?
I mean, that's good. No, that would be a good thing. I would have been happy. No, it was just more, they just potentially weren't all in. And I totally get that people need things outside of the sport. Like, that's balance. And people would probably say to me, you didn't have that balance. And I would probably agree with them. But that's the way I wanted to do it. But in doing it my way, I needed to understand that there were other ways and they were no better or worse. That was just their way.
So how did you come to understanding that?
I like to be curious. I like to listen to different podcasts. I like to read different books. And I guess there's somewhere in one of these things, I like to listen to like Oprah's Super Soul Conversations and Russell Brand's Under the Skin. But all of these people you learn from, and you, their experiences and how they've dealt with different things. And I think something along that, and I don't know, it wasn't like a aha moment, but somewhere along the way, it's made me think about things in a different way.
Yeah, that's, I have to say, that is the beauty, I think, of podcasts. Yeah. Like that, you know, you do get such a different view of the way people are thinking. Right, let's fast forward to 2012, because frankly, you're as hard as nails as well as everything else, aren't you? Okay, home games, and you must have been very, very excited right up until not far into your first match when you got a hockey stick right in the mush.
Yep, his dream start as well. We were 4-0 up against Japan, who we'd normally kind of had really close games with, 4 minutes to go, and I'm just so competitive. And you say I'm hard as nails. I mean, most people would just say I was stupid because I went in for a tackle that I really didn't need to go in for. And I got a little bit of the ball, and in doing so, the Japanese right winger had already started to swing a stick to hit the ball, and just obviously got no ball and got follow through all on my jaw, and just must have caught me in a real bad spot or a sweet spot, whichever way you look at it. And I just felt straight away my whole bottom row of teeth on that left hand side just pop up.
Oh.
Fractured the whole jaw, God. Right underneath the teeth. It was a straight line almost all the way underneath my teeth, all the way back to the back of my jaw, and just that whole thing just felt it pop.
Crikey. But didn't you have a cramp as well? And you were thinking, yeah. Right, yeah, let's focus on the cramp first.
Anybody that's had cramp knows that everything must stop. At that time, only the cramp can be dealt with.
I mean, I've had cramp, but I still imagine that a fractured jaw would hurt more. I've got to be honest.
It must have been shock or something, I don't know. But the physio was like, yeah, Kate, there's blood like pouring out of your mouth. Can I just sort that out, please? I was like, no, seriously, can you just pull my toe back? I've got really bad cramp.
So did you think at that point, right, that's it for me?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
But it wasn't.
No, I mean, it was like the 24 hours of was like a comedy sketch in some kind of dark comedy. I went back to the medical room, and you know that thing at the dentist when they like suction all the saliva out of your mouth? There was two doctors back there trying to get this machine to play ball, and it was flying around the room. This air suction thing, wire lead, was just flying around the room, and I was like, is this for real? Are these like proper doctors? And then I got into the ambulance, two lovely ladies from been brought down from Yorkshire to help with the 2012 Olympics, and they didn't know where they were going, where the hospital was, so we got lost. And then eventually had all these scans. The doctor came out and said, yeah, you fractured your jaw. There's no, you can't play any more part in the Olympics. And then he went, you can play maybe you could play the last game. And I was like, really? And he's like, no. Terrible joke. I was just like, what is this?
That really is a terrible
joke. It was really, honestly was. And then I just remember sat up. I couldn't lie down because blood was basically pouring down the back of my throat. So I sat up the whole night just thinking, well, what an idiot. Why did I do that? Why did I make that tackle? My wife, Helen, was not wife at the time, was now captain in the team because that was our process. So she was being professional doing that. Obviously, coaches, staff, everybody was there. And it wasn't until the next morning when the surgeon, Dr. Holmes, came in and he said, I think we can fix you. And I was like, he is... not sure about this. I'm really not sure. And he was so confident that he just passed that confidence on to me initially. So I had surgery, put three plates in, wired some of my teeth together, everything inside my mouth. He wouldn't even give me steroids. He would have been allowed to use steroids as part of the operation. We would have had therapeutic use exemption. Mm-hmm. But he said he didn't want any question marks. So I looked like a Moomin. People don't know what Moomins look like anymore. I'm like, Google it. Yeah, I was missed. I watched the South Korea game in my hospital bed. And then I got out of hospital, started trying to train and get back, and went through all the tests that were going to be required of me. Had a brilliant medical team. Strength and conditioning coach was just amazing at that time. Sat on the bench for the Belgium game, I think won 3-1. And then I got my chance to come back against China.
And then led the team to bronze. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, I say to everybody that you would do the same. Everybody would do the same. Given that chance, given the circumstances, given what's gone into that moment and the incredible medical team, our physio, Emma Batchelor, our S&C, Dave Hamilton, I just had brilliant, brilliant people.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free.
or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
But that must speak to your sort of determination and resilience to be able to come back. It can't just have been down to the fact that, okay, you've had this process and the doctor said you could. But, you know, there had to be a real drive on your part as well.
Yeah, I guess it was the team, the vision. You know, what in 2009, we decided as a group of 28 women that gold was going to be our vision for London. And we really genuinely felt like that was a possibility, having got lots of good results in the lead up. And this was once in a lifetime. And because I'd been all in, and because this was my everything, I was going to, in every way I could, try and take this opportunity to get back in.
So you got your bronze. Were you happy with the bronze, having set the goal for gold?
Having lost that semi-final to Argentina 2-1 and it been devastating for 24 hours because your dream's gone, to turn that around in the manner that we did, and that group that went out and played for that 28, the way they played in that bronze medal match was outstanding. So, yeah.
2 years later, 2014. So, you know, you've got a medal in the bag and hopes are really high for the team. You go into the World Cup and thinking podium, you know, pretty much nailed on. But you had a pretty horrendous time of it and actually came, what, 11th out of 12?
Yeah, I mean, it was a kind of a difficult period, that 18 months. So we had a lot of change. New coach come in, new methodology, new culture, new tactics, new style of play, new everything. And we started off okay. We got silver medal at the European Championships in 2013, but something wasn't just quite right. And nobody could really grip it or understand what it was. And it just wasn't the environment that we'd created.
Right. In terms of togetherness and that type
of
stuff.
Yeah, we were so selfless. That group of 28 in the lead up to London was incredibly selfless. Just some of my best memories are of people just giving all of themselves, even though they know they're not going to the Olympics. But it became quite selfish.
Right.
You know, similar people, you know, lots of the same players, but different parts of their personality were brought out, and we were all struggling, really. And so it wasn't a surprise that where we finished the World Cup, but it was nevertheless devastating.
And then that led to the team conversation where you all got together, that hard conversation that we mentioned earlier, where you set out values, a vision, asked, you know, who do we want to be internally and externally. So what was that like, and how key was that conversation?
I mean, massive. I mean, prior to that, I took a period out. It's a hard place to be for all of the players at that time, all the staff. Helen had double back surgery. So as a couple, you know, Helen was going through just an awful time. She'd missed out on selection for the World Cup because of her back. She was really struggling. Together we were struggling. It was just a bad, bad time. So I needed to just take myself away. And Danny was brilliant. He'd come back in as coach at this point, and he said, okay, you're going to have to earn your place back into the team. You're going to have to go through the development squad. And I was like, totally fine with that. He let me go away. And over that period of me being away, the group that was still continuing forward had a really, really hard conversation where kind of no elephants in the room, get everything out on the table, all the problems that we'd had, you know, all of the finger pointing, all of the blame, let's just get it all out there. And then off the back of that, progressed a period of healing, and that conversation that you had around, well, who are we and how do we want to be remembered, and how in 18 months can we turn this ship completely around? I feel really strong. There was a real large group of us that had gone through that process in London and really understood the importance of the culture piece, and so we're kind of bringing that to the table then in building our new culture for Rio for the last 18 months.
So that hard conversation, did that then lead to getting back into the selfless rather than selfish?
It started the process. I mean, you know, it was just going to take more than one meeting. I'm under no illusion that... Yeah.
But once you've aired your dirty, you know, you can move past it,
yes,
I guess.
Yes, you have to get it out. You have to. I go into lots of companies now and talk about culture, and so many of the problems are things just unsaid.
Yeah, and bitterness builds, doesn't it?
God, we're human. We're emotional, we're human, and we store it away.
2016, Rio 2016. No one had you down. I was kind of surprised at this. No one actually really thought of you as big favourites or even necessarily medal contenders.
No, I mean, because of 2014, we'd actually turned. I mean, it was a real long process. But in 2015, we won the Europe as England. We won the European Championships and beaten the Dutch on penalties. So there was a belief in us. Certainly, we'd had really good kind of results through the way. We also lost a lot of games, and even in the tournament just before the Olympics, the Champions Trophy, which was in London, I think we won one game in that tournament. And people, for that reason, we were able to fly under the radar. We knew what we were capable of. We needed to tweak a few things, and we got the opportunity to do that after the Champions Trophy, but we knew what we were capable of.
The togetherness in the team was absolutely integral, wasn't it? So you go into the final against the Dutch, who are going for a hat-trick of golds. It comes down to the final shootout. And as well, what I found interesting was like the poise that you have, both before the game and after. And everyone else is sort of, you know, bouncing around, whatever, but you are kind of almost like a marble statue in both instances. Was that
on the outside?
Yeah, on the outside, exactly. So was that an intentional thing to be seen as a rock of stability?
I think some people would probably laugh at you saying that, because I'm really emotive. So right. You see it in me, particularly in my face. But I am very, as I grew up as a leader, I was very conscious of how I behave, how I act, what impact that is having, not only on me, but on other people around me, but at the same time not being a robot. Honestly, I can't tell you the number of hours had gone into talking about the processes of, if it's a draw at the end of time, what are we going to be like as a group? Are we going to celebrate? Actually, we know we're confident for these penalties. What's the process of the coach coming down, telling the five players that they're taking it? Everything had gone, been in so much detail, the hours of practice, the statistics, the analysis, everything in that moment had been set out. And that's because of our coach, Danny Kerry, left no stone unturned, and he is methodical. That is his absolute strength. And so everything was just mapped out. And so it almost just felt like we were just in, and because we'd beaten the Dutch on penalties in the European Championships, we just felt like this is meant to be now. And it was just an amazing, amazing feeling. Just the whole 2 weeks, you know, we won 8 games out of 8. It's just unheard of. We were just in this zone. And it was all about the group that was there, the reserves who were there, who couldn't get to play. All the players back home hadn't been selected. It was a proper, proper team effort.
Yeah, that togetherness was the it seemed like it was the absolute key element. So you talk about, you know, selflessness and being greater almost than the sum of your parts.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, one-on-one individual players, we had some outstanding world class players.
Yeah.
But as a team, we were the best team. And I think that's in terms of our mentality. And that doesn't happen overnight. And it's not just said with words. Mm. That's intent in your everyday training, in the decisions that you make. Are you putting the team first? And that's why, you know, we talked so much about the 31. But we owed it to the 31, because we're doing all of this every day back at Bisham Abbey, our training base, knowing we don't know if we're going to be selected or not. And yet here you are, you're going to give it your all. Mm. And that continued all the way up to, you know, after selection, those non-selected players keep training. Mm. That's hard. Mm. You've had your dreams shattered. And I just think they are the most incredibly strong women. So then when we're out there playing, you're playing for them.
Mm. Yeah.
Because they would be there in a heartbeat. So you better give it your all right now.
Yeah.
And it was, I think, the bonds of trust and respect that were formed because we allowed ourselves to be vulnerable with one another. We completely backed each other. We weren't best friends, but trust and respect was unbreakable.
And you can see that when you all get up, like you're all holding hands and that kind of, that togetherness was so evident. Sharing that moment then, because I've seen you looking down at your gold, like looking somewhat sort of tearful, but sharing that moment with the group and the group beyond, obviously the people on the pitch, like you say, what was that moment like, and how conscious of that sharing with others were you? And how did that feed into the emotion you were feeling?
That's the thing. God, I'm going to set me off now. That's the thing that I was thinking when I was looking down at that medal, I was thinking lots of things, but I stood on that podium, I was really thinking about, you know, all of the women who'd given everything but not had the opportunity to try and achieve that dream. You know, we didn't qualify for the Athens Olympics in 2004, and, you know, for some of those women, that was their last time to wear that GB shirt, and that always fueled me. And so I just felt like part of that medal was absolutely for them, because I wouldn't be there. Mm. I wouldn't be there without them. And then, you know, you think this incredible staff who just put in the most ridiculous hours, who could be doing, you know, earning more money in private practices or doing other things, but they care so much and they've given so much, you know, and they don't get a medal. Mm. You know, all the friends and the family and all the people that have had to put up with our, at times, being very selfish, making choices and decisions that, you know, put them a little bit on the back burner. You know, it is for them. And I think we, the kind of wider society, we tried to have an impact on this, on the wider society. And that, it, so it was, that moment was more about everybody else than me.
At the risk of setting you off again, what was it like as well then sharing the moment with Helen as well?
Yeah, there's somebody caught a perfectly timed picture, because we're in number order. So I'm 11, Helen's 8, and Susanna Townsend's 9. So she was stood in between us. And so we kind of both got our medals, and we kind of just lean back behind Susanna and give each other a little high five. And it's, you know, not many people get to do that with their spouse. You know, it's just to feel so, so incredibly lucky to have... one, experienced it, and two, experienced it alongside Helen, and particularly because for Helen, that last 4 years was incredibly hard.
Yeah.
But I mean, that says everything about the woman that I love, the woman that I know. That's just the person that she is.
Right, let's get on to a few of the lessons then. And the first one, I think, really is the importance of then connecting with a vision. And, you know, despite the fact that you weren't necessarily all great mates, but having that set out vision and that selfless attitude gave you so much fuel.
It has a great impact on many levels. I think having that joint vision, that first and foremost, we'd been empowered to build ourselves. So that, I think, was the big thing. And, you know, that's really courageous of Danny as a coach to say, OK, group, what do you want our vision, values and behaviours to be? Because, you know, who knows what we're going to come up with? So there's an element of trust there from him. There's an element of bravery. And a knowing, I think, of the group, that he had a good number of very good leaders in that team. There was a good number of people that were going to lead this in the right direction. And I think he trusted and believed that. And so, yeah, and then in the lead up to London, our vision for gold was massive. We were ranked 8th in the world at the time when we made that vision. And there are times when, of course, we all doubted it, I'm quite sure. But it allows you to fall back on to something. It allows you to challenge against something. It allows you to build your review structures and feedback sessions and everything around, well, look, this is what we said we're going to be about. Are we being about it? And so that's what we did. So in the lead up to Rio, we wanted to be the difference, create history, inspire the future. And we checked ourselves against that all the time. Danny checked us against that all the time. Are we doing that? Are we living our culture? It can't just be words on a page. It has to live and breathe in everybody.
Do you still have a values and vision-based approach to life? Because, mm-hmm. like, for example, I know that, you know, you and Helen, like, I know you spend a lot of time going into schools, mm-hmm. and, you know, you take your responsibility of being a role model, for example, normalising same-sex marriages as much as you possibly can. You take that very seriously. Is that a conscious sort of values, vision type thing? Or is this just something that happens sort of unconsciously?
No, and I do keep saying this when I go into schools or into companies, and I say I feel like I'm a little bit of a fraud, because I was so vision, values and behaviours driven as a player, and I kind of need to go through that process again, and I am starting to go through it. But certainly that the vision for Rio is still my vision. I still want to be the difference. What difference can I make for myself, for other people? I think creating history is, yeah, possibly not at the forefront of my mind, but certainly inspiring the future. You know, what do we want the world to look like? for us as individuals and for us as a collective. So I think that those two things in particular do drive me, yeah.
And so, and where does that feed into then, you and Helen, and the role model aspect that you are both, you know, adopting?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because it's almost just part of us. We don't go into schools and talk about, unless we're asked to, we don't go in to talk about our relationship. We go in schools to talk about strength, to talk about having vision, to talk about, you know, being resilient and overcoming setbacks. And whilst we're there as a couple. And that's just part of it. And I think that's, you know, so I was quoted recently and I got a bit angry because it felt like they were kind of saying that we go in schools to promote our relationship, which is absolutely not our intent at all. We want to go into schools to just talk about those other things. And when, by the way, we're in a relationship and that's totally normal. And be more prepared to challenge things. You know, I had an email the other day from a hotel that we'd stayed at and it said, Mr. and Mrs. Richardson Walsh. And, you know, I'm going to reply to that person and just say, you know, don't assume.
And the thing about hockey, though, is it was no big deal. And this is the whole point, getting to the point where it's not even a conversation.
Yeah.
But the difference between hockey and other sports, so we look at sports like football, to a lesser extent like rugby, same in America, you know, where there are very few people who are out. Whereas in hockey, it's no big deal.
In women's hockey. Yeah, and right. I think it's important to make that point because I think still in male sport generally, I think it's still very taboo. And I think a lot of that is based on, you know, this has been talked about a lot, but it's a lot of it based around that, you know, traditionally, what do we see as male characteristics? What do we see as female characteristics? What, you know, if you are a man playing sport, you're supposed to be strong and brave. And those characteristics are not traditionally what's seen as characteristics if you are homosexual. And it's just about, for me, just breaking down all of those pigeonholes and stereotypes and just break them all down and just be like, this is Kate. This is who Kate is as a person. Part of Kate is that she is in a same-sex marriage with Helen. But that's not, you know, it doesn't affect my values or what you judge me as a person. So it's, we've got such a long way to go on that. And I'm so hopeful for the next generation coming through that they, you know, are going to demand a more open view of the world. However, there is still an awful amount of bullying that goes on in schools and because of, for any minority group. So, you know, whether it's people with, young people with disabilities or people from ethnic minority groups or LGBT people, there are still people being discriminated against every day for being who they are. Which is just wrong.
Something I find quite interesting about these bigger sports, you know, your footballs and so on and so forth, there is this perception of it being all about confidence. Like people are expected to project a real aura of confidence. Yet the fact that no one really has felt able to be themselves and come out, there's a hell of a lot of fear actually in these sports that base themselves and pride themselves on conveying a sense of confidence.
I mean, why would you come out to publicly? Because I very much believe there are male footballer players who are out to their friends and family and teammates, but they choose to keep that out of the media and out of the public eye. I really genuinely do believe that. And what? And you can see why would you come out? Look at the horrific racial abuse that some of those players undertake on a daily basis. And it would be exactly the same because sexuality is something you don't see from the outside. So imagine it would be the same. So you can see why would you put yourself through that if you don't need to. So it's about changing minds. I think that's a really hard thing to do. I think it's about the authorities and organisations being more vocal and being harder on that discrimination and abusive behaviour. And it's about allies and people speaking up. And I think the more we have that, I hope the better it will become.
Right, let's talk about some of the things. So you are into schools and you are talking about things like pressure and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Pressure Thursday.
Yeah, so Thinking Thursday, it's become infamous now. I mean, so you'd get an email Wednesday night, so we'd have club training, so you'd get back in at about 10 p.m. You'd get an email from our coach, and you would be put in a team for the Thursday morning GB session, and it would be kind of 5-a-side or maybe 6-a-side. You'd get put in a different team each week, different captains each week, different rules of the game each week, different size pitch, different point scoring system, and you would have to, as a team, find a way to win. And you would then also be throwing quite a few curveballs during the session. So you might get a player just taken off you in the middle of the game. You might be sent off in the middle of the game. The coach might constantly blow the whistle against you every time you touch the ball. And how do you cope with that? Under that pressure of needing to win, and you're now being prodded. Emotionally, how do you deal with it? Physically, how do you deal with it? Psychologically, how do you deal with it? And so you learn a lot about yourself, you learn a lot about your teammates, constantly being pushed out of your comfort zone. And it was hard. It was mentally and emotionally hard. This is one of the last sessions of the week, hockey-wise. So your fatigue levels are so high, but you're having to think very, very clearly. So it kind of fed into a little bit of the kind of Clive Woodward's, you know, teacup, thinking clearly under pressure, mentality. And it, you know, for me, I'm an emotional person, so I would be like anger management for me every week. As the, you know, you're sent off for no reason or blown fouls against you for no reason. It was good. It was brilliant.
But what I found interesting as well is though that this can be applied to anyone. And you suggested when you went into one of the schools that I saw you talk at, and you said, you know, it's valuable for anyone in any walk of life to know how they react in terms of thoughts and feelings to pressure. It made me think, you know, how few of us actually do know how we react to pressure. And then we get swept up in, you know, maybe panic, maybe anger, whatever.
Mindfulness is a really massive concept now, and everyone's talking about it. But you need those kind of exercises or questions, I guess, to make you think about it in a certain way, to be curious, allow yourself curiosity of, has my body language changed right now? Has my tone of voice changed? How are my interactions like? You know, what are they like? What's that internal voice saying to me? Has my heart rate gone up? Like, or what happens? And then you can start seeing triggers and signs and start, you know, if you are going into a bit of a negative spiral, you can shorten that if you stop it sometimes. And we found that really powerful as a squad and as individuals in that squad.
You said yours was, you'd perhaps get a bit emotional.
A bit aggro.
Mm-hmm. Others would withdraw into themselves. So what advice then would you have for someone who perhaps isn't aware of how they deal with pressure?
I think it's first of all building in a bit of time to think about, and if you can do it in the moment, brilliant, but even if it's just afterwards, be thinking about, okay, how did I perform today? What was I like going into it? So can you remember what mentally you were feeling like? What preparation physically did you do? And then what did I feel like during it? What was I thinking, feeling, looking like, performing like? And then afterwards, you know, what do I feel about it? And then you'll start to, over a period of time, build up a bank of information to say, okay, look, when I perform well, it's because of maybe these things, and this is how it feels at the time. And when I don't perform well, this is what it looks, sounds, feels like, and these are probably some of the reasons why that is. And how can I start either eliminating, sidestepping, overcoming some of these barriers or obstacles?
And then would it be about how to perform when you are in the midst of those sort of kind of low moments, if you like? Performing when we're not at our best, you know, is hard, but we all have to do it.
Yeah. I mean, that, and I do feel very lucky that because we trained together, particularly those last 7 years when we were full time, every day together, at least one person on any given day out of the 31 or 28 was having a bad day. And it's, so I guess that was the motivation of, well, somebody here is also might be feeling the same as me, or tomorrow they'll feel the same as me. And actually on those days, I'm listening to your podcast with Tani, she was just like, get yourself out the door. Just get yourself there. Get yourself through it in whatever manner, and be proud of the fact that you've done that. Because if that's what you can deliver on that day, nobody can ask any more of you than that.
Yeah.
So just deliver what you can on that day. However bad you're feeling, you will be making some impact in some way. So that's good.
You talk as well about the importance of trying to not get too high and too low. So staying within a kind of, I don't want to say a narrow emotional range, but kind of, you know, so the highs, you're not getting carried away, and the lows, you know, you're not falling into the pit of despair.
Well, I think first of all, it's acknowledging that there are ups and downs, because I think you talked before, you said about I look like a statue or a kind of... and
stoic, I think.
Yeah, but I was for a long time tried to be this kind of robotic, you know, don't show any emotion to the group. And actually, that was a detriment to me as a person, and also a detriment to how I was leading the group, because... who's going to follow a robot? You know, that's not human. They can't, nobody can relate to that. It's not real life. We all have, as you said, we all have ups and downs. We all experience things in a different way emotionally. And so I feel like once I'd opened myself up to that, and I think seeing a therapist for me really helped that. It was for me about monitoring the levels of that. And of course I got it wrong all the time. Like I would absolutely get over the top in training and get too into it and get really angry or aggressive or, I mean, the other way was much worse for me, actually. The other way, being very withdrawn and quiet, was when you knew I was really, really struggling.
Mm. How would you cope with that, being withdrawn?
So I think having shared that part of myself with some of my teammates, you know, actually lean on them a little bit in those moments. So if it's happening in a training session or a game, you know, there are other, everybody was a leader in the team, but there were other very, very, very fantastic, competent leaders. And just because I was wearing the captain's ribbon or the captain's armband, it doesn't really matter. When you're out there playing, everybody needs to be a leader. And so actually, you know, Helen in front of me playing centre half, Alex playing in front of her, Hannah, Krista. I mean, there was just so many littered throughout the side that actually it's okay for me to be not feeling okay right now. And actually they can lead. And I can't be all things to all people all the time. And I just need to do the best I can today. And they will be grateful of that, and I need to be grateful for myself for that. And so it was just being a bit kinder to yourself, to myself, and not asking things of myself that just were not going to be possible for that day when if I was feeling really bad. I think for me it was just being human, cutting myself a bit of slack, holding my hand up, being honest to be able to say to the group, do you know what, I'm really struggling today.
That's really hard to do.
So hard. It's so incredibly hard. Of course it is.
And that's what you hear so often, particularly men, who isolate and withdraw in, just having the bravery really to say to someone that I don't feel great. I think it's easy to project how people will react, but actually that's almost invariably the first step to feeling better.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's for all of us to create an environment where people feel they can say that. So it's not just that person, having the confidence to say it. It's actually for everybody else to create an environment where those people, because it will be you one day, can feel they can say that. So whether that's on a one-to-one basis or, you know, we had body groups, which were really powerful. We had our leadership group, of course. So there was, you know, lots of opportunity to share at least with one person that you're struggling. And like I say, there will be days when I was missed. There'll be days when we missed that person struggling, and we didn't support them in the best way that we could. But the intent was always to try.
Mm. That openness and selflessness was absolutely integral to your success, the team's success, wasn't it?
Yeah, being vulnerable with each other was huge. And it's, you know, for some people, like, you know, we were saying earlier, oversharing. Like some people totally comfortable with that. Tell you their life story in a heartbeat. And then there's others for them that is their worst nightmare. And it's an understanding that, again, both of those is okay and one is not better than the other, but providing people with the opportunity to share and the level that they feel is appropriate for them. Mm. And we were really, really vulnerable with one another. We shared all of our, you know, ups and downs within the hockey team, stuff that was going on outside, of course, and not with everybody. But somebody in there will know, and maybe sometimes even not the person that you're most close to, but there'll be somebody there that you'll have shared something, a part of you with, that is very raw and very real and that nobody else will see. And that binds you together.
Mm.
I think there's something human in all of us that if somebody opens up to you in that way, there's something innate that we want to care for that person in some way. So I think that was huge.
Right, just very finally, when you go and you do your talks in schools, you know, on your own with Helen, what if there was, if you had to sum up like one thing you're trying to get across, what is it?
Being the best version of you that you can be and not being afraid of that. Because I think for lots of people that's, and we're going to quote Brené Brown now, but daring greatly. I love Brené Brown.
I love a quote. Go for it.
So it's from the Teddy Roosevelt quote of, it's the man who, and woman who's prepared to put themselves in that arena knowing that they may fail, but they might win, but that they all have to deal with either consequence. And it's the constantly putting yourself in that position that is terrifying for lots of us. To really put yourself out there and say, I really want this. And I might only want it for a day, a week, a month, a year, or I might want this to be my life goal, but I'm going to dare. I'm going to dare to do it, and I'm going to deal with the consequence of that. And whatever that means for you to be able to thrive in that way is to embrace it.
Yeah.
And that is it for me, is just being prepared to be comfortable in your own skin and just be very proud of who you are and be curious about that and grow and fail and learn and all that good stuff.
Kate Richardson-Walsh, OBE, thank you very much for coming on Don't Tell Me School. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
I hope it all goes swimmingly in December. Thank Please you. Pass on my kindest and warmest wishes to Helen. And it's been an absolute pleasure having you in.
Thank you. Thanks for having me in. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of Don't Tell Me The Score. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation. And I would, of course, be delighted to hear your thoughts, ideas and questions. Do get in touch via my website, simonmundy.com. I do really appreciate you listening. And if you could leave a kind rating and review, I would be sincerely grateful. All that remains is for me to say, I hope you'll join me again next time. Until then, thank you and goodbye.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.